from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I want that bill. That bill must be on my desk by noon on Monday. Noon on Monday, send education funding to my desk. Noon on Monday. And if it is not on my desk by noon, I will call special session for the General Assembly, demand that they come back here to Springfield and do their jobs every day until we get schools funded and open on time.
I've lived in Chicago for 50 years. In that time, Jim Thompson was governor, Jim Edgar, George Ryan. You know, and I disagreed with them sometime, but I never thought that they were unfit for their jobs or evil people. And that's where I am with this governor. It's pretty profoundly disturbing.
Evil?
Yes, this is a person who cut funding for autism programs on National Autism Day.
That's the Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle not holding back when talking about Governor Bruce Rauner. She made those remarks in an interview with Bill Cameron on the WLS program Connected to Chicago. Before that, we heard the governor trying to speed up the inevitable showdown on school funding. Are we looking at another big showdown? We will talk about that and more on State Week in Springfield. I'm Sean Crawford, and joining me in studio today, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. Also, Matt Dietrich, writer for the Better Government Association, and Kent Redfield is joining us. He's a professor emeritus at UIS. Kent and Matt, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Sean.
Yep, good to be here.
Let's start by going to this education funding situation that has been created by the passage of a state budget. Brian, you want to give us the quick overview of why this is an issue right now?
Yeah, well, Illinois has had a thing that it's called the formula, right? It's the way that the state sends money to local school districts across the state. And that formula has been in place pretty much unchanged for almost about 20 years now. And people on both sides of the aisle have agreed that that formula is outdated, it's not fair, it doesn't equitably distribute money across the state. So both sides have pretty much agreed on that a new version of this formula is needed. There was a gubernatorial commission, they negotiated it, and when Democrats and a few Republicans finally passed a budget earlier this summer, they put that new formula as a requirement in the budget. The problem is they haven't actually passed the new formula into law. So as it stands right now, money cannot be distributed. State money cannot go to schools until some version of this new funding formula is put into law. And that's basically where we stand. The governor does not like the version that the Democrats are pushing, which would give some extra money to Chicago for its pensions. The governor is talking about if the Democrats send him that bill, without getting too much into the weeds here, that he would veto it. But that's where we are.
And Matt, this is not necessarily such a complaint about giving the local school districts more money. It seems to be Republicans and Democrats have agreed that some of these districts need to be brought up a little bit, but this has to do, or at least it's being made out to be, an issue of Chicago versus downstate.
Right. And what the governor and a lot of Republicans have said is that this is a bailout of Chicago public schools, which is another way of saying it is overly generous. And this is an interesting point, and this is where the political backdrop of this cannot be avoided. If you go back to November, what happened in November was the General Assembly had passed a bill that was going to provide $215 million to Chicago Public Schools to be used for its pension system. Now, what happened in November was and there had been an agreement that had been in place since, I think, the summer before, that Governor Rauner would sign this bill into law if the General Assembly passed a pension reform bill that the governor and Senate President John Cullerton had agreed on. What happened in November was President Cullerton made a public statement where he said, well, there was no deal for us to, the governor needs to sign this bill to help CPS, but there wasn't an exchange. It wasn't a deal that we had made that was written in stone. I think the governor must have heard that because almost in real time, the veto came out right then. And for me, what the problem that this creates when you look at SB 1 is that that bill, that $215 million, was not viewed as a bailout back in November. Had they passed pension reform, Rauner apparently would have been fine with signing it. Now, all of a sudden, when it's that $215 million has been restored in SB 1, now it's viewed as a bailout. So it wouldn't be a bailout if we had this pension reform in place now, which, by the way, I suspect we will see that at some point in the future. President Cullerton has been very explicit that we will bring that back when the timing is right, not in an election year. So to me, when you talk about this being a bailout, I see it as changing. And ever, you know, the word bailout, it seems like the definition changes depending on the circumstances.
Kent, is this I guess what is going on here with the governor? He's changed, I guess, his tone on it, as Matt was mentioning. So is there a reason behind that?
Well, I mean, certainly the governor, having lost the budget in terms of, you know, what happened with the override, then, you know, everything gets played through the prism of, you know, how is this going to look in 2018? What kind of leverage can I use to make me a winner and the Democrats losers in terms of, you know, whatever the issue happens to be? And so, you know, both sides are saying, wow, you're holding the children hostage and putting the children at risk. And this is something that probably should have happened 2.5 years ago in terms of resolving the original budget stalemate, is the pressure point that would have really gotten us off the dime initially would have been schools not opening in the fall of 2015. But, you know, we took that off the table, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons and did the same thing in 2016. So, you know, we're back to another pressure point. I mean, there's certainly policy in this. You know, you go back to the 1995 law that changed the Chicago schools and tried to deal with Chicago pensions, which they'd always picked up their own pensions, but they'd also had a tax, a dedicated property tax for that. And the new law took that away, but it gave the city a lot of control over the budget. The state was supposed to be giving them money to, you know, make up for the fact that they weren't getting pension money the way that other school districts were. You know, the state reneged on its promises. The city made a whole, and the school board made a whole bunch of stupid decisions. And so, you know, we've got the pensions are a mess. There's no question about that. But it's a very long history there. And this is about holding everybody harmless. And then how do we distribute the new money? But part of the fight of holding somebody harmless is, what is Chicago's fair share? What are they currently getting? It's pretty easy for another school district because we know, you know, we're treating them all the same. And so there's certainly policy in here, but it is a political fight. It's about advantage for 2018. And you know, we want to get kids back to school, but we'd like to look good and make the other side look bad in the process.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to emphasize that, you know, Chicago does not get the same pension treatment for its teachers that every other school district in the state does. The state picks up that cost, the employer cost of teacher pensions everywhere but Chicago. And so that is something that the district up there says puts them at a disadvantage. But there are other ways that the funding is different for Chicago schools. They get a big block grant instead of some of the individual funding items that go for other school districts. And the idea was that was just supposed to kind of, I think as Charlie has said on our program in the past, kind of streamline the funding for that. But you're right, Ken, too, when you say this is a political fight and it's about political advantage. We've seen the governor consistently oppose a lot of different things that would help Chicago financially because he has said that he doesn't think Mayor Rahm Emanuel is pushing Democrats in Springfield hard enough to go along with his agenda items, which include things like workers' compensation and limiting the power of public employee unions, things like that. Just earlier this summer, he vetoed a bill that would that actually became law, despite his veto, over 911 fees, and it would allow an increase in cell phone fees as more people have gotten rid of landlines.
the phone use has shifted to cell phones, and we're trying to enhance 911 systems so you can text emergency instead of just calling and get your location more easily when you do that. So he had vetoed that bill. Chicago would have had a cell phone fee increase because it seems he didn't want Chicago to be able to raise that tax. And we've certainly seen Chicago raise taxes quite a bit in the last few years.
If this was Facebook, we'd say it's complicated, I guess. It's the status between the legislature and the governor. Matt, one thing that the governor has been very strong on this week, message-wise, has been going around saying how these other school districts are going to lose money under this plan. They would gain money if you took that Chicago pension payment out of there. Does that put especially downstate and maybe even suburban Democrats in a bit of a bind here?
Well, this is where it gets difficult because you didn't have complete SB1 passed the House with the minimum 60 votes. You did have one Republican in the House, was the lone Republican in the entire General Assembly. That's Michael McAuliffe. He's the only Republican in the House whose district is in Chicago. So this is very tenuous. And this is – I'm not trying to skirt your question, Sean, but what we're seeing now is this is a game of chicken. And the Senate has not sent the bill to the governor. As we heard at the outset of the program, it's held on to it to create more pressure because the later he gets a hold of that bill, the less time there's going to be between when schools have to have their money and when either they can work on either overriding the veto or changing the bill so the governor will sign it or, approving or not approving his amendatory veto. What you're hearing from the suburban reps and senators is, they get a lot of pressure because they see this ultimately as less state money coming into their districts. Even though this does hold everybody harmless for now, it kind of ramps it over the years. It's gonna smooth out. One other point that I think we need to bring up in the political background on this is that, and Brian, you and I sat through committee hearings back in, I believe it was January, that the Governor's Commission on Education Funding released a big report and the conclusion of that report was we need to go to what is called an evidence-based model where we look at each individual school district, what challenges do they face, low income, English as a second language, how many disabled students that you need to determine a per pupil funding level based on all of these things, not just one flat rate throughout the state. But what happened was, and there have been many commissions and reports on this issue over the years. The Governor's Commission came out with its report very early this year, but then did not push a specific bill from it. And I sat through committee hearings where I know that Andy Menar, who's a Democrat senator from downstate, and he's been a big issue on changing this for years, where he over and over asked Rauner's Education Secretary Beth Purvis, where is your bill? What will the governor sign? We need you to be, you need to forward us a bill that we can work on because we have to know what the governor will sign and what he won't sign. Beth Purvis's position and the administration's position is, hey, we leave that up to the legislature. That's why I think you ended up with these two competing bills. And I do think this is another example where the administration has been kind of ham-fisted in how it goes about, Also, this is one that Beth Purvis said the governor likes 90% of SB1. Well, you like 90% of it. In politics, that's usually a victory.
Well, I would say this, and Kit, maybe you can elaborate on this, but many a political career has been made, especially downstate in Illinois, by running against Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely no question. And so the numbers here are soft. I mean, when the governor puts out a spreadsheet, Yeah, well, is that we've taken $400 million of the block grant and dumped it in the pool? Are we taking the $250 million of pension money and dumping in the pool? So the numbers are soft in terms of exactly, you know, what's going to be split up. And then, you know, this is not only for 2017, but this is going forward. You know, I've seen a couple of analyses that say, you know, SB1 looks at not only per pupil, but also district kinds of considerations going forward. If a district loses population, you know, they're not, there's some smoothing in terms of that. If you lose 10% of your students, you can't get rid of 10% of your buildings. What the governor at one point was backing was something that was much more geared to the individual student. And over time, that would mean that suburban school districts who are growing would be advantaged, and downstate school districts that are not going to be growing would be disadvantaged. So this is a very, very complex area. And frankly, you know, if we're in the posture, and I think we are, where you got to have 71 votes and 36 either to accept or override because you have to have an immediate effective date, we could easily be there. I mean, you can call all the special sessions you want, but if you can't get a 3/5 vote for either to override or the mandatory veto, then you're back, you know, maybe where we were with the budgets, where we've got to get some rank and file members together to, you know, to throw something, you know, there that you can get some votes on. I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, there are a lot of outcomes here, and a lot of them are not very good.
Yeah, and I mean, the governor we heard at the top of the show threatening to call a special session. Well, he called 10 special sessions at the end of June and ended up having a budget forced down his throat. He certainly didn't like the outcome. He vetoed that budget, and that budget deal came about after those special sessions anyway. So you're right, Ken. If you can't get the votes here, I'm not sure what a special session would necessarily achieve other than to just draw increased media attention to this as it did at the end of the June. And who knows, maybe that would be something that would get people moving again. Although I would think that the threat of your constituents not knowing where they can send their kids starting in late August or September would be enough.
And boy, Ryan, that is what this really comes down to in this game of chicken. If the governor, if he vetoes this, he knows full well what the numbers are, that this is, there is no guaranteed override here. If he vetoes it, and if the General Assembly calls his bluff, who's going to get the blame? And I think the governor's rolling the dice that, well, if we see chaos throughout Illinois, they're going to, I can message it so that I can blame Mike Madigan and the Democrats for failing to enact this, whereas the Democrats in the General Assembly are gambling, if it comes to this, would be gambling that, no, he's the governor. People are going to blame the governor in, 2018, oh, 16 months away to the next election, that we're already talking about this stuff.
Yeah, and it is for schools, it's not a hard deadline because, the 186 here in Springfield has said, we can get to January without any state money. Other superintendents are saying, if we don't get what the state owes us plus the new money, we can't open our doors in August. So it's depending on the fiscal health of your district, this is going to become, it's either an immediate crisis or something where, you've got some wiggle room. I mean, yeah. It is a very, this is just, you're really rolling the dice in terms of what the damage that could be done and also, who the public would blame.
And if you follow this stuff, last year there was a time when it was Illinois and Pennsylvania were the two states that didn't have operating budgets. And Pennsylvania's the breaking point for Pennsylvania came because they didn't have a school's budget. And when school districts there ran out all their possible options, that's when it broke for Pennsylvania. So there is some precedent here that, yeah, schools might open in the fall, but boy, it's not going to take long before this is be a real big problem.
Yeah, and just two other little wrinkles here, just to further complicate matters. Democrats are pointing out that, remember, if the governor's veto had been had held on the budget, there would be $0 for schools as it was anyway. So they're saying, you know, it's rich, sort of rich for him now to come along and complain that the Democrats are holding the schools hostage when he, in fact, is the one who vetoed the money that would be appropriated by this budget. And I think there's another interesting wrinkle here is that you have the governor now calling for this bill to be sent to him, and he says he would, you know, this Democratic version of this so-called evidence-based funding model, and he says he would write it with a Republican version of an evidence-based funding model, and yet most of his new staff, which he has systematically replaced in the past couple of weeks, has spoken or comes from a policy organization, advocacy organization that opposes that sort of school funding model. And so people are wondering, and some of his – he set up this website, Matt. You referred to the numbers that he's put out there, although it's not quite – clear how he arrived at those numbers. And he's made statements that contradict some of what he says on that website in interviews. So it's not exactly – people are wondering what exactly this rewrite would look like and what role would his new staff who has opposed this funding model – you know, there's just a lot of open questions here.
Oh, exactly. And you know, the new staffers come heavily from the Illinois Policy Institute. And when I was editorial page editor at the State Journal Register several years ago, we would occasionally run op-ed pieces from the Policy Institute when they were fairly new, and it was an interesting conservative voice to enter the discussion. But their education pieces tended to be very they had kind of a one-note quality to them. Don't give public schools any more money. They're only going to waste it. The unions are going to wreck the schools. We need to give more of our money toward charter schools. We need to get school vouchers. It was that way over and over and over again. And so I am curious to see how does this roll into the administration now?
And Kent, I think it's good that you're here because maybe you can give us a little background onto the funding of the Policy Institute through the years. How has it kind of come to be?
Well, it is, you know, it's a non-for-profit that does not disclose their donors. Now, some of them, because the governor has released information about his contributions, we know that he has been a big funder. But the Policy Institute is a part of a loose network that has of non-for-profit, kind of think tank. They are basically, in terms of orientation, economic liberty, free market kinds of approaches. They tend to not get involved with social issues. So, I mean, they are conservative, but more towards the libertarian kind of bent. But there is heavy financing in terms of a Koch Brother Network and some of the other independent expenditure groups that have been very active on pushing the Republican Party in general, but more specifically that kind of free market economic liberty kind of message. And so you'll see things from, you know, the Texas Policy Institute or the Wisconsin Policy Institute that sound, you know, quite similar in terms of the orientation. I mean, they're all different and they're not one big organization, but there certainly are close ties. And this group is also linked to the Illinois Opportunity Project, which put money into the Ken Duncan race last time around, and now their director of that organization has now moved into the campaign side of the governor's operation. So it's not only been on the policy side, but now that the former head of the political operation, and I cannot pronounce Mike Z's last name, but, you know, he resigned, and now we've got somebody that was associated with the Illinois Opportunity Project. And John Tillman is, you know, is a president or, you know, a key figure in both of those organizations.
I think it's Mike Zolnarowicz, I believe, if that's correct, but it is a tough name to pronounce. Brian and Matt, in the few moments we've got left here, I think Kent brought up a good point there, the changeover. Not just that we've seen on the policy side. I mean, that might be something I was a little surprised to see change like this on the political side of the Rauner operation going into an election year so close as we, you know, get ready to launch this reelection. Surprising. And do we have any idea what this might mean?
I think we're still going to waiting to figure that out. I think the governor clearly wanted to go with the the sort of Policy Institute people to do his policy side, but it looks like he also wants to go in that direction on his political operation. And Mike Zee had been sort of credited as one of the masterminds of his election victory. I mean, he's a guy who won, the first Republican who won here since the 1990s in terms of the gubernatorial election. And so – and he did that by appealing to the middle and not being a sort of ultra – economic liberty, conservative, libertarian, however you want to phrase that, which is what the Policy Institute is all about. So it's really going to be interesting to see what sort of message he tries to bring in a state where we also have President Trump ginning up people who support him. The governor has distanced himself from the president or tried to just talk about him as little as possible. And we're going to see – people are expecting Democrats to be kind of worked up. It's common that in the first midterm election of a presidential year, the other party tends to do better. And Illinois is already a blue state. So the governor is certainly going into some headwinds here.
And Matt, just about 45 seconds or so, but your thoughts on this as well.
Well, I think that the big question is going to be when 2018 does roll around. Governor Rauner did not win by a gigantic landslide in 2014 by any means. And he almost didn't win the Republican primary because the unions came out against him during that time. So now he has really, really gone full bore onto the ideological side with the Illinois Policy Institute. So again, as Brian said, this is going to be something extremely interesting to watch. How is he going to get those suburban moderates? You got to win 20% of Chicago if you're going to win statewide in Illinois. He had a pretty kind of a weak candidate, a weak opponent in Pat Quinn. I don't know what's going to come this time.
Time now for our notes from the field. Kent, let's start with you.
There's been a lot of talk lately, an attention on the decline of rural America and, you know, what's happening outside of the metropolitan areas. It's not just an issue involving, you know, small towns and unincorporated areas. There was an interesting study that came out that looked at negative migration in cities of 250,000 or less. And four of the cities that had the biggest rates of negative net migration in their study were in Illinois: Rockford, Kankakee, Decatur, and Danville. It's not just the rural areas that are losing population and under economic pressure, but medium-sized cities, as it's certainly in Illinois, are feeling that kind of pressure.
Matt?
It took over three decades after Watergate for America to learn the identity of Deep Throat. And right now in state government, those of us who watch state government, the big question is the identity of the owner of the Twitter account at Radical Candor IL. This is a Twitter account that popped up right during the Rauner staff purge. And here is a sample tweet. It says, quote, "Leak. Rauner to announce next week he's getting tough on crime. Prisoners will now be required to work in the governor's office." So a lot of us are awfully curious who the prolific and very funny author of Radical Candor, Illinois is.
Top that, Brian.
I don't think I can top that, but I will note that former U.S. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert has been released from federal prison where he was there for a banking violation. He was fitted with an electronic monitor of the sort that you would have for home confinement, although the sheriff's office there wouldn't confirm that he was on home confinement. He came out as part of that he had committed some sexual abuse of high school students when he was a wrestling coach in the 1960s. Illinois did change its law for future crimes like that. There is no more statute of limitations as a result of his past transgressions.
That will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast, Brian Mackey, Kent Redfield, and Matt Dietrich. Production assistance this week provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.